Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to You're Booked. This week we're hanging out with the writers Atessa Moshfegh and Luke Goebel. Before we get started, I would love to tell you all about the Creative Confidence Clinic. This is my special Substack club for readers and writers. I'm sharing essays and practical and emotional hacks, tips and tricks. We've got masterclasses with some of my favourite creative people too. You can join the community on Substack if you'd like the full caboodle, including a discount on my next Write Like a Reader course. Go to creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com/subscribe/booked. Yes, it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's so worth it because it gets you the half price offer and I'm only offering it to podcast listeners. I've got an exciting event coming in February. At the time of recording, dates and details are to be announced, but if you go to theyardhampshire.co.uk/events, you may be able to see it. And if you'd like a personalised, signed, dedicated copy of my latest novel, Limelight, or any of my books, go to themargatebookshop.com and make your request on their contact page. They deliver nationwide. Now, on to today's guests. We're celebrating the film of Atessa Moshfegh's novel, Eileen. We talk to Atessa and her writing and real-life partner, Luke Goebel, about body horror, Atessa's hatred of Christmas, Guy de Maupassant, and calling up Ken Kesey for a chat. Enjoy. I wanted to ask you both, but Atessa, maybe you especially, making Eileen the movie, how did your relationship with your original text change? Did you feel differently about the book or see it in a different way as you brought it to the screen?
I mean, I think I fell back in love with the book, to be honest. There was a time after the book came out where I like really didn't want to think about it or touch it or look at it. And it was nice to pick it back up again and do it with new creative energy and also be on a team for the first time. And I don't know. I think I appreciated it in a new way without all the pressure of having already written it.
That sounds good. That sounds quite joyous.
Yeah.
As much as that book can be joyous, yeah. Which I think it is. I think it is so strangely exhilarating.
Me too.
And Luke, how, when you read Eileen for the first time, were you seeing it in a cinematic way or did that kind of change and evolve as you...
Yeah, I was reading it in a cinematic sense, perspective. It's like one of those weird twists of fate. I had read everything else by Atessa, and I had somehow been waiting to read Eileen. And then the kind of notion to adapt came to us both, and the opportunity happened, and I read it with that in mind. So I think it was like hiding from me, waiting for the perfect moment, because it was fated for us to make this movie. And for some reason, I needed to encounter it at that very time for the first time. There's a lot of magic around Atessa like that. Things just sort of have their their natural way.
Did you find out anything new about each other when you wrote this together? Because you've had a collaborative relationship for some time. I'm sure you've probably talked about that a lot today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd worked together on another film called Causeway. And in general, our relationship has always been so much about our work and what we want from it that it was not a huge leap for us to work on Eileen, the screenplay, together. It's always kind of interesting when you see someone doing something you've never seen them do before.
Yeah.
So seeing Luke working on Eileen, you know, everything that he added was unexpected to me because if it wasn't me coming up with it. So that was really exciting. And having having another perspective, someone who's also a fiction writer, which is really lucky, who can understand the challenge and special difference between a novel and a screenplay was really helpful.
Curious about Luke's novel. When you read that, did you know each other already? Or did you get to know each other kind of on the page?
I had met, I think I was already engaged to Luke maybe when I read 14 Stories or whatever. I knew we were going to be together when I read it. Yeah.
And I met Otessa by interviewing her. So I had just read Homesick for Another World and showed up at her apartment to interview her about that book. So yeah, we've been collaborating in one way or another from the moment we met. That was a conversation, that was a collaboration, you know, as all interviews are. So, but I just remember working on Eileen together as like being really exciting, showing each other new things that we could do, having done this insane rewrite on Causeway in like a 9-week period under a ton of pressure with filming being imminent. It was such a, like, suddenly we had freedom. Mm-hmm. We weren't being told what to do. You know what I mean? We didn't have a deadline like that. It was totally ours with Will. We'd kind of come up with the concept of the film, and then we were writing, and we were kind of just showing each other, like, well, here's what we can do, you know?
I think I've read that interview, and one of the things I loved is, sort of, Luke, the way you talk quite explicitly about in Homesick for Another World, and I think as a reader and a fan, I think there's a theme, I don't know if you agree, that these books are very physical, and all these stories about the things our bodies do, the things that we maybe prefer not to talk about. And that, you know, I love that so much watching Eileen as well. This is a woman who sweats, a woman who feels uncomfortable in her clothes. You know exactly how that house smells as soon as you see it on screen, and it's not good. I'd love to know about other novels, other stories that you have both enjoyed that have that same kind of slight, you know, physical sense of unease.
Luke, you brought up The Piano Teacher earlier today.
Yeah.
And that's another book to film adaptation that really captured just the uneasiness of the physicality of the protagonist and how uncomfortable it could make you. For very different reasons, obviously, but
I mean,
it's
just
palpable.
Riffing Conception Days. Isn't that Joanna Novak?
Contradiction Days.
Is fairly bodily. I mean, Bret Easton Ellis has some fairly bodily in a different kind of vein.
Like which book?
Like American Psycho.
Yeah.
Some of the graphic physicality.
Yeah, he kind of goes there in a
and
transgressive way. Yes, his new book as well.
Sexually, yeah.
I haven't read his new book. And he's a writer that I've got a really complicated relationship with because I read him too early and
right.
I so wanted to love him and be impressed by him. What I quite like about American Psycho, I think, is his horror of it. And I don't love the unapologetic misogyny, but the way he's about women and what their bodies do, I think it's so frank and so... I think it's interesting to read him now with... you know, writers like you guys who are something. I think there's a warmth to all the shit, etc. Whereas in his books, it's cold.
Yeah,
they're opposites in lots of ways.
Patrick Bateman doesn't really have a lot of compassion for his subjects.
I wanted to ask about a book list I read. And there's a book you recommended, and I cannot remember the title, but it sounded amazing. I think it's got hope in it, and it's a nonfiction book, and it's a writer talking about living in Palestine and being on the Left Bank. And I thought that would be such a great book to read now, I guess.
Oh, it's by Ben Ehrenreich, and it's called The Way to the Spring,
yes.
I believe. Yeah. I mean, not to get into the current issue. Yes. It came out. We shared a publisher. And so when I moved back to L.A., my publisher said, oh, you should look up Ben Ehrenreich because he's living in L.A. He's since moved to Spain. But he became a really good friend. And actually, we rented out his office in L.A. for quite a while, which was in this amazing part of town.
Right off MacArthur Park.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And yeah, we could never find that office again. It was just like a room on this really dilapidated floor of a medical building in the middle of this strange part of town. Yeah.
Yeah, it was under $200 a month. It was great.
That's incredible. Yeah. I lived there.
Yeah.
And what's it like sharing that writing space? It sounds like you must be able to be really relaxed with each other. Is one of you a faster writer? Are you kind of, do you harmonize? Do you get frustrated? Is there someone who's like the talker and someone who's the scribe?
I mean, I think basically, like, wouldn't you say that you're more of a extrovert than I am?
Yeah, I generate the ectoplasm and she materializes it.
I'm
Ghostbusters writing.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm more, I do most of my thinking live on the page. Like, I find it very hard to write without actually composing. But Luke can do it, like, standing in a room, you know, just out loud in a way that is interesting.
Yeah, I'll generate dialogue and also kind of create and field concerns, like larger, like thematic and theoretical and structural issues that need to be addressed and solved. And Otessa is amazing at action. She's also amazing at dialogue and rearranging, editing, putting things in different places. We'll take turns. We both, you know, you share on final draft. You both have a computer. You both see the screen. But, you know, one person will take turns kind of in the lead as a writer, or both are writing in different sections. Mm-hmm. It's always different.
Yeah.
With Eileen, it was like a trial by fire. Every single word had to be written, spoken aloud, and agreed on, or else it got cut, and then we did something else. Like, there was no sharing of, you write this part, I write this part. Yeah. It was all together.
That makes so much sense, because I think in that world, so it's not typical, I think, to have a novel that has so much fullness and then see something on screen that's so full but also so spare. It's kind of a quiet film. Like, there's not a ton of dialogue. Mm-hmm. You want that sense of those spaces and those, you know, there's so much unspoken. So, you know, it does absolutely see that every word had to count.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you both about the first stories that you connected with, who you were as young readers, and, you know, the first, you know, whether they were like novels or something else that just gave you the sense of kind of what a story could do and the writers you wanted to become.
Mm. Well, that's a really good question. I didn't realize that this answer was going to be controversial until I was at Stanford and I answered the question in a group of other writers, and realized that I have always been a writer who puts drama and language in front of content and like the actual story materials, because the short story that inspired me to be a short story writer was The Necklace by Guy de Maupassant, which is about a middle class woman who wants to go to this ball, basically, and be the most beautiful woman there. And she borrows a necklace from a wealthy girlfriend. and goes to the party and has the time of her life with her husband. And afterwards, she loses the necklace and spends the rest of her life paying back the shop from which she bought the replacement and never told her friend. And then there's this devastating ending where she finds out that actually the necklace was a fake at the very end. And she's, you know, completely ruined herself, having been a washerwoman for decades. You know, this young woman who had once been very lithe and beautiful is now this really calloused and heavy and angry, resentful washerwoman who finds out at the very end of the story that her suffering was for nothing. And I just, that just blew me away. But what I didn't realize was, like, if I shared that story today, people have a lot of problems with it, because it's a really not, it's not a very feminist story. It's sort of like looking at a woman in her most superficial desires, you know, and it's about vanity, basically.
It's very Thomas Hardy-esque as well, isn't it? Like, really, like, punishing a woman. She just wanted to be seen for one night.
Yeah.
And she has to punish herself for the rest of her life. Do you know that story, Invitation to the Waltz, by Rosamund Lehman?
Oh, I think I read that a long time ago.
It's very kind of classic English 30s, but about being 17 and pinning all of your hopes on a party. And half the book is the party. And it's that loss of innocence by realising how tawdry these people are, and this sort of longing to thinking things are going to change, and they change for her sister and not for her. And I love those books, and I love that so much. And I think until really relatively recently, for women in stories, that was the only way you could travel. Like, we write about being seen and being beautiful in parties, having your life changed by a party, because that was the only way, which I guess brings us back to Eileen yearning for escape and not knowing quite how that's going to come up.
Right.
Luke, I'd love to hear about your...
My first thoughts of myself in relationship with writing was as a poet. So I was reading a lot of poetry when I was young. And as far as, a formative experience, I guess, was I read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I had just moved to Portland, Oregon. So I called information, and I got Kesey's phone number, and we talked for like an hour on the phone.
How old were you?
I was 12.
Oh my God. What?
That's fantastic. Yeah. Can you remember any of
that? I remember exactly what he sounded like. Yeah, I remember the conversation. He was just like, first his wife answered the phone, Faye, and then she was like, called for Ken, and there's a young man on the phone for you. And he just goes like, hello.
And so you talked for an hour, but he said three things.
Yeah. It took a long time for him to say anything. Yeah.
Did you know what you wanted to ask him when you rang? Did you have questions?
I didn't even know who he was. I mean, it wasn't until much later that I realized who he was as a counterculture figure, or, you know, anything. I just had read, the book and was like, I liked it.
Did he tell you anything about the book?
He wanted to know what I thought a lot, which I like went on and on about. And then I was just like, trying to see if you wanted to hang out.
What did you tell him? And did he want to hang out? it was a different time, but maybe not so different. You could, as an adult man, hang out with random.
I think you could. It was Portland. It was Portland in like Oregon in 1993. I think, and he was Kesey. I think anything was game. I just told him, how much I liked it and what I liked about it and the character, the fact that all the houses were the same, the conformity, stuff. I was very young.
Well, you liked the conformity?
I liked what he was saying about it. Okay. I could relate to it, it was pretty, pretty pedestrian 12-year-old stuff.
But I think that when you come to a book when you're 12, what's so great is you don't know or care what's pedestrian. Your experience of reading is so pure. You're not coming to it with a load of, like, this is what the critics thought. And that's something that... I sound like 1,000 years old, like, the trouble with writing today, but I miss not knowing things about the culture I'm falling in love with. I hate the fact that I can talk myself out of going to see something or reading something accidentally because I've read 9 pieces about it on Vulture. I'm like, oh, but everyone's problematic. And having that, being as ardent as you can when you're 12. Tell me about the poetry. Which poets were you reading?
I mean, it's sort of in those same veins, Ferlinghetti, to Prima, like, you know, I was in that Pacific Northwest subculture. I just moved from Ohio, from a little farm town, and I hit Portland, and it was just sort of, you know, the counterculture was still alive and buzzing, and I was just kind of digging into what was available.
And back then, were you going to libraries and bookstores?
Yeah.
And
yeah, and people were reading things, teachers, you know, little Marxist old teachers in Portland public high schools were introducing us to these things. I mean, that's all problematic now, too. It's like, oh, God.
What is?
The Beats.
I've never read any Beat, anything.
Right. Yeah, you shouldn't.
It just never appealed to me.
Right.
And it's like the musicality of it, I felt like was so long-winded. I couldn't get into it.
It's so funny that you said that, because I was thinking about how when I was reading the Beats or trying to, I was also of an age where I was, you know, young and hanging out with boys and trying to pretend I like things like Metallica. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes Jack Kerouac has, oh, great, this is another song that's 14 minutes long. Thanks.
I can't say I ever tried to like Metallica. I feel like I would appreciate it more now.
You would love Metallica.
Yeah. I haven't really
Maybe
tried
not.
It.
I don't know.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
We'll be back with Atessa and Luke soon. But now, it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen The Book of Delights by Ross Gay, a collection of daily essays written by the poet about the things that bring him joy. Watching a praying mantis scaling a pint glass, having his brother-in-law break a turtle out of his partner's father's garden jail, and seeing a stranger laughing at themselves after accidentally opening an umbrella indoors. This is a beautiful book about paying attention. If you're in a reading rut, starting your day with a few minutes of delight with Ross is a wonderful thing to do. The Book of Delight is published by Hodder & Stoughton and out now. Now, back to Atessa and Luke. I wanted to ask you both about how much you recommend books to each other and any books that you've given each other as gifts and how that goes down. If you have similar tastes or if that's something that you're quite disparate in.
I think it's pretty disparate. I mean, sometimes we'll both be reading a book at the same time if we're considering it as a co-writing adaptation or something. But usually what happens is Luke will read something and he'll talk about it. And then I'll think, okay, maybe I'll read that when you're done. And then I won't. And if I'm reading something, I'll kind of keep it a secret because whatever book Luke finds, he will read. And he's stolen a lot of books from me that way. So I just keep it to myself, read it on the sly.
And Luke, what have you stolen?
What have I stolen?
Every book. Every book that comes to me
in
the
mail. I mean, first of all, a lot of books come to Atessa. You know, they're near daily deliveries of ARCs, of, you know, Advanced Reader Coffees. So I grab them all.
And I never read them because I never have time. But you always read the beginning.
Yeah. Give a lecture.
Yeah.
That's about it.
But I have to say, you know, this has been consistent since, I don't know, probably since grad school. I find it really hard to find the time to read. And the older I get, the harder it is to use my eyes for that many hours a day. And mm-hmm. so by the day, you know, by the time I'm done with a day of writing, I can't read, really, like, literally can't read. So it's, I'm more selective about what I do read. And I think as a result, I might be choosing books that are less difficult.
Yeah, I mean, between, like, right now we've got two screenplays that we just handed in, promoting Eileen. I've got a book that needs revision. You've got a book that needs written. It's, like, hard to find time.
Can you talk about the screenplays that you've handed in, or is that all?
Well, one of them is actually with the director of Eileen, Will Oldroyd, and that's a really exciting project. It takes place here in the UK during World War II, however.
Yeah, we can talk about that one.
It's about a psychic medium.
A real-life psychic medium, Helen Duncan.
It's inspired by the true story of a woman named Helen Duncan who was a rare kind of medium in that she could materialize spirit outside of her with ectoplasm, speaking of which. And so, yeah, we've been thinking about that a lot. And she was kind of famous and infamous and was the last woman in England to ever be tried for witchcraft.
And convicted.
Yeah. So her life is very interesting.
Because she revealed a national secret about the HMS Hood being sunk, and that was during the war. They didn't want that out. It was a strategical advantage for that to be kept secret, and she revealed it in a seance. But yes, she did materializations where she would either ectoplasm or cheesecloth, depending, would, you know, these forms would billow out and people would see in the red light faces of their loved ones, and you know, it was a part of the whole spiritualism craze.
That is going to look incredible on screen.
Yes.
But I love that period. I love that move. And again, I think it's another one of the few ways that women could kind of travel. Like when, you know, we were not participating in the workforce, medium was one of the few jobs we could do. And I often think as well about everything kind of in that area and how that's evolved and, you know, what wellness is now as well, which is a nebulous term that means everything and nothing. I think, you know, maybe it's no wonder that women, especially over time, have been so drawn to that world because, you know, all so much in the way of, like, autonomy has been denied to us. So we're like, yeah, I'll ask a ghost. That's as good as anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is also just maybe one of the strengths that women have been able to hold on to, which is our intuition, but also got us into a lot of trouble too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time of recording, we've just come off Halloween. We are coming up to Christmas. I would love to talk to you about Christmas ghost stories, Halloween horror stories, festive books, spooky books, anything like that, anything that really evokes that feeling of winter for you on the page.
Gosh, I mean, it's so funny.
Eileen, obviously, is a classic Christmas book. Or maybe you're not pairs well with Bad Santa in terms of, like, festive vibes.
Right. No, I mean, it is kind of like a horrific Halloween-y Christmas book. I really don't care for the holidays. I mean, it's funny that I write so many books that center on Christmas because it's such a heavy and unpleasant time of year for me personally. I just always felt so trapped. I mean, there's something about not going to school, and I grew up in the Northeast of the U.S. where all winter there's just tons of snow. I mean, it's very hard to move around. I felt so trapped at home on Christmas vacation, and it was like this prison time where I couldn't go anywhere and I just had to stay home with my family, and it was supposed to be happy, you know, like this was supposed to be a celebratory time, not, we weren't religious or anything like that. So I have strange associations with Christmas, but I find holidays to be very useful in fiction because they are sort of imposed event that can come and be, I don't know, either interrupt a life or be something that a life is building up to, but also the shared experience that we can all relate to in some way.
I just finished a book that was for a possible IP, Where You End. It was...
Where You End?
Yeah. And it had like weird, freaky Halloween cult vibes. And then, of course, you know, the Bible.
Oh, yeah. The first Christmas
book. Classic Christmas book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you like being horrified as a reader? Do you find it easy to have that creepy feeling? Or does it take a lot to move you in that way?
I mean, the things that really horrify me are more believable phenomena, like aliens, things like that. Like, I've not that I think the idea of extraterrestrials is terrifying, but I think the literature around it is often very scary.
In that interview, did you mention a book you read by a... Because I remember reading the word and kind of being like, ufologist? Ufologist? Like, how do you say that?
But there was something... Ufologist.
What was I talking about? There was one book I read recently...
The Hunter of Wyoming.
No, that was insane. That was such a strange book. My sister sent it to me. My sister is like kind of a scholar on UFOs and aliens, but she sent me a book that was like definitely a print-on-demand thing written by the wife of a hunter in Wyoming who had a close encounter with aliens. It's like this horrible book, really badly written, like the kind of bad writing that it's like the subject changes halfway through the sentence and you don't know what she's actually saying.
I thought it was just experimental.
No. Uh-uh. It was an account of a close encounter. But no, that wasn't it. It was something else.
I do love the idea of taking that book and like sending it to Fitzcarraldo or somewhere and being like, look, this is wild.
I know.
This is like, it's winning the Booker.
Yeah.
Because it's so, so experimental.
It wasn't that
good. What book on a ufologist?
I can't remember the title. It's a really famous book about aliens and how, well, not about aliens. It's about extraterrestrials who visit humans and the trauma cycle that occurs after, which is a real thing. I mean, whether it's really aliens or really some sort of sexual assault buried under a repressed story, who knows? But it was very scary. I think Communion is the name of the book. Communion. That's a terrifying book. I like couldn't sleep. It was so scary.
Yeah, I guess that trauma is going to be the real result, whatever it is or isn't. While we have time, I really wanted to talk to you about My Year of Rest and Relaxation, because that book, I would say it comes up... there are certain books that come up all the time on this podcast that people love, and that is one of the most regularly occurring. And normally I mention it or someone else mentions it. I love that it's so funny. I think about Dr. Tuttle at least once a week.
Me too.
I mean, how do you feel about that? Because I'm also, that's kind of my Atessa Moshevek gateway drug book. And what's your relationship like with that book? Is it something that people want to talk to you about a lot? Because I think it feels so... in a way different from your other work, and maybe the most kind of inner world that we recognize.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that book has reached a lot of people, and I think that it holds some appeal, perhaps because the main character is someone you don't mind relating to because she's so pretty.
I always thought it was, for me, it was that universal fantasy. Who doesn't want to drug themselves and watch their life
result? I don't know.
It's like that meme about sleep. It's a little death as a treat.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, too. But the girl, the young girls that come to me and that say, like, oh, I discovered you through this book, aren't talking about sleep. They're talking about their unhappiness. And I think that it made that book made their unhappiness look attractive so that they could communicate it without shame.
I think that's interesting. And I know, I feel like in literature there's been this sad girl moment. And I mostly read that book as being very, very funny.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was the correct reading. Do you think that's shifting? Do you think we're all kind of getting sick of ourselves? Or do you think that the kids on BookTok are going to keep this sad girl moment going forever?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think it's generational. Understanding satire takes a certain degree of maturity because you need to have hindsight and learn how not to take yourself so seriously, which is really hard when you're like 17, you know? I definitely took myself way too seriously.
You've just finished reading Kankisi in a very literal way.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know. The sad girl thing, I don't, women don't identify as girls in my experience. Like, I know when I was a girl and I know that I'm a woman now. So I'm not a sad girl. And I think that everyone will grow out of that.
It makes me think of like Courtney Love and Kinderhor and the sort mm-hmm. of the Riot Girl movement, that sort of wanting to be, you don't have to take any responsibility for yourself if you brand yourself a girl. You're like, this is how vulnerable I am. And I can see why now in a very, very frightening world that why a person might cling to that, I suppose.
That's terrifying.
Hold on. I saw your movie and I can't believe you're saying I terrified you. That's nuts.
No, it's a terrifying idea that people would cling to misery. It's terrifying because people do it all the time. Like, oh no, you don't ask anything of me. I'm too depressed. And I think it's sort of like a second wave misogyny where women are like choosing to take themselves out of the running because they're so mentally unwell.
I think it's really astute what you're saying, but I don't think it's necessarily limited to women or women being girls. There's men who are boys who stayed perpetually adolescent, and it's often entwined with addiction and counterculture, and it's a way of being like, I'm not joining the troops. You're not getting my enrollment or enlistment. Like, I'm out. Like, I'm staying here.
I feel like there's a movement, at least in the States right now, where the male version of that is like becoming a mass shooter.
Well, or in a lot more populations, larger numbers, people just staying home, not interacting, becoming depressed, asexual, mentally
like internet
ill,
addict.
Like, yeah, retreating into a state of inability to function.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I take the sad girl term very seriously because I really don't want girls to take a book that I wrote and use it to justify staying out of the world and being sad and limited in that way.
I think that's really, really good point and really interesting and really complicated when it comes to that sort of, Foucault and sort of who is the author and who are people to tell you what your book is about.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's not... I was talking with a friend recently about horror, and when I was a kid, there was a real spate of kind of this movie made these kids go and murder another kid and ban this movie and it's all sticking to them. And I really, when I was sort of 7 or 8, I it was like The Ring before The Ring. I was like, if I see the wrong movie, I'm going to kill someone. And that sort of I think in the US and the UK, I think sort of the tabloid cultures are a little different. I think they exist in both spaces. But I think here it's maybe somehow more vulgar and more universal. I don't know if that makes sense or if you agree, but that sort of the way we're quite simplistic. And again, I think it's something we do when we're younger as well. You find the one thing and you're like, that's me, that's who I am. And forget that, we all contain multitudes and we need to. We need to kind of expose ourselves to multitudes. But yeah, I was, when, you know, I think, Luke, that's a brilliant point. And I was trying to think, what, there must be those books and those stories. I don't know if they are. I don't know if the, to use a horrible and offensive cliche, the guys who are living in their parents' basements are reading books in the way that the sad girls are. Mm-hmm. Is it? Different, the sad boys, are they looking
what
for different
are they
things?
Reading?
I don't think they're reading novels. Mm.
They're reading 4chan. Is 4chan
still doing? Yeah, 5chan.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
They're reading Simone de Beauvoir, thinking about being an incel. I don't know. Whatever's happening, I have no idea.
I'd feel a little better about the world if the incels are reading Simone de Beauvoir.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Could you reach them? Could you both maybe, I don't know, write the incel novel that, you know, makes them like take a shower and see daylight and be in the community?
That's kind of what I'm trying to do, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm working, no, I mean, no, I would never put it in those terms, but yes, I mean, I'm working on a novel that is very much about a young man who doesn't want to feel. And it is definitely not a, it's not a, like a depression or whatever you want to call it, is not gender specific. And being young is being young, and having human feelings is overwhelming for all of us. So,
yeah, and those people sort of factor into my, especially the culmination of my new novel that's coming out this year. I mean,
oh, is that next year?
2024, fall. Yeah.
Which is, it's practically the end of 2023, isn't it? Do you have a title? Can you tell us anything?
Yeah, it's
about
called
it?
Kill Dick.
Great name.
Thanks. Among other things, it's a revenge fantasy. But it's a lot of different things. It's a counterculture work that in some ways is addressing kind of why people are living in their basements, unable to function. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to read it. It sounds like what we all need right now. Sadly, I think we're coming near the end. I'd love to know if I could give you, and this is a gift I can't give you, but I wish I could, if I could give you a month of year in, of rest and relaxation for reading, or sleep on drugs, if you like, but let's say reading for the purpose of the podcast. What books would you really like to go back to that you've loved if you had?
Edith Wharton is an author whose novels I've started many times and then said, okay, I'll read this for real when I can really dedicate myself to it. And so I've never finished a single one of her books, which is sad. I think I would probably just go read her.
I love that. Have you read much Henry James?
No.
I kind of read them together, and mm-hmm. they've both got that kind of vibe where it's all looks and subtext, and no one ever says what they mean, but in a really great way. And I often think that as well about Wharton, who I read when I was a student, and not really since, but I'd like to go back and I might read House of Mirth and Portrait of a Lady together.
Exactly.
I'd probably read all of Otessa's books.
Again? Yeah, right.
That is a very, like, break the internet answer. You are... Is it Tom Hiddleston in the I Heart TS t-shirt?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Someone was just telling me about that.
I always get my celebrity Toms confused.
That was just last night. That was Thomason.
Oh, yeah. Thomason was telling
us that last night.
Thomason is so good. I had never seen her work before, and her chemistry with Anne is sort of mesmeric. I couldn't take my eyes off her, and I loved her accent. I thought, and that sort of Massachusetts that, you know, sometimes a bit like Fargo, where it's not the sort of, as a dumb British person, you hear a very fairly generic US accent, and that really kind of beyond outside the city anyway, but I thought she was incredible.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Her Boston accent is really good. I've seen some people being critical of it, and I think those people have probably never been to Boston.
Yeah, they think that it's like the stereotypical, like, cliche movie, like, you know.
Well, people think that the
Matt
Boston
Damon
accent
or whatever.
Is a Southie accent. It's just not.
And also, she's not in Boston. She's in coastal Massachusetts.
Right.
It's different.
She is not parking her car in the Harvard yard.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Sorry, that was horrible. Huge thanks to Otessa and Luke. Eileen is out on general release on the 1st of December.
and the book is published by Vintage and out now. You can find a list of all the books that Tessa and Luke mentioned at acast.com/booked and shop a selection on our page at bookshop.org. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and created by Dale Shaw and me, Daisy Buchanan. You can find us and follow us on social media at whybooked. And we really, really love and appreciate 5-star reviews from our lovely listeners. It helps people to find us and it helps them find their new favourite book too. Finally, I leave you with this from Diana Vreeland. There's only one thing in life, and that's the continual renewal of inspiration. See you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.